my mind, the type of spirit one read about existing during the Dixie Mission,
right.
There was a particular good feeling. I might add, too, that I think a very significant number of the top military in that room had fought in the Korean War.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I think there was some, it was, both sides had very well-crafted toasts, as I recall, but there were allusions to the Korean War past and that now we were coming much closer together. That was one of those lunches where you felt the United States and China could even become military allies.
Yes. One always felt that more where there were the two military representatives present than any other time. And late that afternoon, the Secretary had his meeting with Premier Hua Guofeng at the Great Hall. I have no particular memory of that meeting.
That was a very interesting meeting because I think it revealed that Hua Guofeng was indeed near the end of his tenure in office. You will remember that the Chinese side behaved in what I would consider to have been a rude manner. You remember the Chinese usually, in a meeting with Hua or Deng, communicate not at all with one another. They all count on listening to the leader. He may turn to them, as Deng did on many occasions, to Han Xu or Huang Hua. In this case, I remember distinctly Zhang Wenjin just looked at the ceiling the whole time. One of them was down with hand covering eyes and looking down. Very few looked at Hua. And Ji Chaozhu carried out a private conversation in rather loud terms at the end. They behaved as an American delegation.
Yeah, now it comes back. That's true. That's true. It was very disrespectful. But Hua just acted as though nothing untoward was happening.
And the American side, by the way, I was just somewhat disappointed in the American side because some of our people on our side did the same. They saw the Chinese and then they got it up and they went off. And it was not a disciplined session on either side with note passing and all of this.
Then that night at 7:30 there was the return banquet. And Defense Minister Xu made another appearance with, I think, three nurses in attendance. So that it was more than just his age that was a problem. And following the banquet at 9:45 at the Minzu Hotel, the Secretary had a press conference. And the press had as much difficulty understanding civilian items with a dual-use technology and military equipment as distinct from military weapons. I think if we had simply said non-lethal military equipment, that it would have been understood, but they had some trouble with that. It was during the dinner that I talked on the side with Zhang Wenjin about the action that China would take at the Security Council meeting, which was still ahead of us. And they were not yet ready to tell us, or they had not made up their minds. Because I then told the Secretary that I thought I should stay back and not go with him as I had planned on the rest of the trip. Because if there were additional meetings on this question, with all the effort he had put into it, that I certainly should be in Peking and be available. So the next morning, which was bitterly cold, I don't think I've ever been out to that airport when it was so cold. And it was for an 8:40 8:40 departure. Gung Biao was out there. And I remember you finally got on the plane. And then we walked back towards the terminal. Gung Biao and I walking side by side. When we get to the foot of the stairs, and I'm ready to bolt up the stairs and in, because, you know, you can't see very much from inside those planes anyway. But he turned around. Tears from the cold were rolling down his cheeks. And I had to stand beside him in all loyalty. And we waved goodbye. And it was really cold. But I'm told that where you went, you touched down very, very quickly after takeoff. And it was even colder there.
That was absolutely horrible. I had developed the usual Peking sore throat and was in very bad shape. And we went to an air base just outside of Tientsin. I think it was maybe 20, 30 minutes away from Peking. And then they put on an exhibition of MiG-19 precision flying. And we were up on a stand, unprotected, and just watched these planes just come over the runway. The god-awfulest thing. I just couldn't wait to get out of there. It was horrible. But that was our exposure to the Chinese Air Force.
Why don't you cover the rest of the Brown visit?
Well, we went... then after this touchdown at Tientsin, we went to Wuhan, and we had selected Wuhan as the place that we wished to go, mainly because there was no other place in China that we could go. We did not, the very fact of Secretary Brown's visit was the most significant part of the journey. It had obviously great potential long-term strategic significance, and then the question is, where could Secretary of Defense Brown go? Given the events in Vietnam, he couldn't very well have taken a trip to the South. He couldn't have very well gone off to Manchuria or Inner Asia. That would have been too much of a signal to the Soviet Union. And so we settled on Wuhan. We settled on Wuhan for yet another reason. It is the home of the strategic reserves of China, the best paratroop units. We asked to see them, but we did not visit that particular base. Instead, Secretary Brown was taken to the major military shipyards that are in Wuhan. And he was there for but 24 hours and then went on to Shanghai. In Shanghai, he visited the East China Fleet, also a memorable visit. The same kind of warmth was evident there that had been evident in the visit to the tank corps north of Peking. Then what, of course, symbolically this meant is that Brown had reached out and met the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. And he had a very good exchange. The naval commander was very bright. And Brown gave a toast and remarks that, again, tried to indicate that the 7th Fleet was no longer to be seen as an adversary of China, that we now faced a common danger in the Pacific, the expanding Soviet military presence and the Soviet Pacific Fleet. The symbolism was not lost on anyone that visit really hopefully symbolized the end of an era of maritime confrontation with China. Very successful. And then Brown went from there to Japan and back home.
Right.
He's a very impressive individual. I gained a great deal of respect for Harold Brown on that trip. He handles himself well. He's very, very intelligent.
Yeah, he was, he did extremely well on that visit, certainly the part that I was involved in Peking.
He also had assembled a good staff. One of the things that this trip diplomacy really enabled one to get a sense of is the staffs of individuals, who had they brought to Washington and assembled as a support team. And I thought Brown had a first-rate press secretary in Ross, Mr.
Yes,
Ross.
Very good man.
The only fellow that I thought was somewhat baffling, the only man that I found somewhat baffling was Robert Comer.
He likes to baffle people. It's just,
did you know him from
before?
No,
but I spent a lot of time talking to him during that visit, and at first I wondered what made him tick, but I've been in some touch with him since. There's a great deal to Bob Comer.
Is he a thoughtful man?
Yes, I think so.
Because he struck me as almost out of the British Empire as a Colonel Blimp, throwback to a Cold War era.
He's been speaking out of late on the whole question of where are we going with our arms thrust and so on. But he has that blustery approach that I had the same wonderment about him at the beginning that you did. But for some reason, he and I had quite a lot of discussion. And in that, you realize that behind all this is a very thoughtful, thoughtful individual.
Well, he certainly picked on some people. His relations with Dick Holbrooke were not the most intimate. They must have clashed over the Vietnam War or something that went way back, because they were just at each other the whole time.
Right. Well, I was right. The next day, Friday the 11th, I had in the morning, a session with Vice Foreign Minister Jiang Wen-jin on Iran, which time he told me they had made a decision. They could not vote with us in the Security Council. They would not vote against us, nor would they abstain. They would simply stay away. They would not be a part of the meeting at all. And that the reason for this was not that they did not support our position, but they were worried that if we were too aggressive new government in Iran, that they well could be pushed over to the Soviet Union, and distressing as the holding of the hostages was, that there could be an even greater danger with regard to that. And why would I be talking to him about grain sales at this point?
Were we beginning the negotiations of a grain agreement?
No.
Oh, of course. Very important. Grain embargo was placed on the Soviets due to Argentina, and we wanted to encourage the Chinese to take up some of the slack and buy grain from us.
That was still pending at this point?
Mm-hmm. Because, well, the grain embargo was just imposed. Right, on the Soviet Union. That had just transpired.
I had discussed that question at the point we did it sometime before, and it's on the record.
Agreement.
Yes, it was about, the president had taken the steps to impose a grain embargo on grain sales to the Soviet Union. And I would have been talking about hoping that China, to some effect, could fill some of the gap because of the political repercussions that this was having. I saw him in the morning on the 11th. I went back again to, let me correct this, I went back again to pursue our case with regard to Iran and to explain that I had stayed behind for this purpose and I was available and so on. And also raised the question in connection with the grain embargo. Then I was called back at 5:30 by Zhang Wenjin. At that time, told that what I had already put on the record, that they could not go with us on the second vote. They would not vote against us. They would not abstain. They'd simply stay away.
You know, it's so striking. It's worth detailing this degree of confidence in one another that we had established in our relations. We shared, in a very frank fashion, our different assessments of world affairs, but really were reaching out to establish a meaningful cooperative relationship. I imagine that the contrast to the way now that we handle such matters as our differences on the Falkland Islands could not be more striking. I bet that the level of discourse, the effort to accommodate each other, minimal at the present in 1982 in Sino-American relations.
I would think so.
But we really had an effective working relationship
right.
with these people at that time, and we were free to differ, but we differed with on tactical matter, really attacked different sense of what the tactical situation called for.
But we could talk about
That's right, and respected our differences.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
Let's stop here.